Would it?
Of course. This is exactly the information I sought.
Maybe. Maybe not. You won't have a clear picture until we speak to Bear Blackboots. Until we get the full truth.
Roan was growing frustrated now. Another emotion he knew Windy wouldn't approve of. Which is why we are sailing to Tarragon. But what does that have to do with this book? Windy stepped forward into the small cabin, placing her half-empty teacup on the table. She leaned over the book, her thick grey curls brushing against the page.
What would you have done if you'd read this book back in Citadel? Before we departed, Caleb?
I would have... He trailed off, realizing he was about to speak untrue. He wanted to think it wouldn't have changed anything, that he would still be sitting in this cabin, more than halfway across the burning sea. But that would be a lie, and he knew it. I would have tried to find Bane. I would have tried to understand him more. Maybe I should have made another decision, he finished lamely. Windy shook her head, leaning back again.
No. Seek wisdom first, and then answers, she said. Going to Bane would have only confused the matter more. It annoyed him that she was so easily able to predict what he would have done. You aren't ready to face him again.
And going to Tarragon will change that? If I could speak to Bane, I could discern the truth. Maybe he is fooling me somehow. Maybe the words in this book, he jabbed his finger against the cover, are taken out of context. It can't be true. We can't be two parts of the same solution.
Why not?
Roan sighed because he didn't have an answer. What are you saying? That you believe what he showed me? She shrugged, dragging a hand through her thick hair.
Maybe. But just because he painted a picture doesn't mean he painted the whole thing. There's lying, and there's lying by omission. Don't confuse the two.
Roan chewed on that for a moment.
You still should have shown me this book earlier. Perhaps. Time will tell. Now, get some rest. You can read the whole book tomorrow if you wish. Come, Yela.
The girl stood, an apology flashing in her eyes, before she followed Windy out.
She knew about this book the whole time, Roan thought.
Scholars, he muttered. He finally fell asleep with his face on the pages of the book. The next day he finished the book, slamming it shut in frustration, not caring that it was an emotional response. Dust flew from the old tome, which had contained no other references to the teachings of the Western Oracle. Yela said,
"Told you.
Don't even start. I'm still cross with you." She'd already apologized several times.
"You know how Lady Windy is?"
He did, unfortunately. "Aye, she is in dire need of a hairbrush and a proper lesson on making tea.
I'm not joking. She swore me to silence."
It wasn't Yela's fault, not truly. Windy was a tyrant when it came to the scholars under her tutelage.
Fine, but I still can't believe she kept this book from me all because of a couple of lousy lines that mean nothing.
They mean everything, he thought. If both Bane and I are truly integral to achieving peace. If so, the Western Oracle was the author of death as much as she was the foreteller of peace. He jammed his fingers into his tired eyes, trying to think. Yela stayed silent, though soon he heard the scrape of pages being turned. The boat rocked. The sound of gentle waves lapped against the sides. A gull screeched.
A gull?
Roan's eyes burst open and met Healer's, whose eyes had widened in response. They seemed to realize the same thing at the same moment, scrambling from the cabin and mounting the dozen steps to the decks. They skidded to a stop in front of Windy, who stood wearing a broad smile on her face. A large white bird with a yellow beak sat atop her head, nibbling crumbs from her palm.
"Tarragon," she said,
gesturing grandly to the starboard side. Sand-speckled beaches gave way to rocky, crescent-shaped hills. Though it was the end of their journey, to Roan it felt like just the beginning. 67. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Anise Gehrig. Every day, Anise expected the sun to fail to rise, or for the moons to hang lower than they used to. But each morn the sun rose, and each night the moons appeared, climbing the sky. Every day the world looked much the same as it used to. But it wasn't. Her world changed forever when Archer died on a voyage she'd brought him on.
"Oh, Archer," she thought now, "how I miss you."
They'd buried him in the Royal Cemetery, right next to their father, their mother. Despite everything her father had done, something about it still felt right. It was only the second day since their return, and Anise knew they would have to leave again soon, perhaps as early as the morrow. The Four Kingdoms faced a danger graver than ever before, and she needed to ensure the rest of its inhabitants were prepared. She'd already tried sending streams to Night's End, Faria, Calypso, and Fenir, but so far had received no response. The last message received had been weeks earlier from Rhea, who'd said her armies were marching on Fanes. Since then, it was as if the North didn't exist.
"It won't, if we don't stop the Horde." The Horde. She could still scarcely believe it,
though Zelda had been persuasive. Anise's eldest uncle, Helmuth Gehrig, had been missing since before she was born. Some said he'd gotten lost and fallen into a pit and died. Others said he was murdered by one of his brothers. Still others believed he was alive, disguised somewhere in Blackstone, just another crippled beggar on the streets. There was even a legend surrounding his disappearance, something about a note he'd left before he'd vanished. Anise had never believed such foolishness, until her aunt showed her the note, which she'd kept all these years. It said,
"I will return one day, and I shall have my vengeance."
Though it was unsigned, Zelda assured Anise it was her brother's handwriting. Once it had been a running jape in the North. People would say, "Aye, when the maimed prince returns," and then burst into laughter. No one was laughing now. It seemed impossible that a crippled boy could set off into the world, sail across the great Crimean Sea, and unify a horde of bloodthirsty barbarians. Anise wouldn't have believed it if she hadn't seen them with her own eyes, if she hadn't watched her brother die at their hands. There had to be more to the story. That frantic feeling clutched at her again as she made her way from her sleeping quarters to the council room. Originally, she'd wanted to sail directly south from Crimea to try to warn the other kingdoms, but they hadn't had sufficient supplies to complete the journey. In the end, it made the most sense to regroup in Castle Hill and decide from there. Well, now it was time to make a decision. She knew what her father would do if he was still alive, still king. He would hunker down, defend their borders, the rest of the Four Kingdoms be damned.
"I am not him. I am not a soulless tyrant."
Anise already knew where she stood. The North was unprotected, their army well-trained but far too small, the Sleeping Knights gone, along with Lisbeth Lorne and Sir Dietrich. Finding them was paramount to the survival of the kingdom.
"They were supposed to be our protectors," she thought angrily. "If they had come with her to Crimea, perhaps Archer wouldn't have—"
She was so lost in her thoughts that she crashed into the messenger running in the opposite direction, sending him sprawling. He wasn't particularly young, but far too thin.
"Is our food supply running low?" she wondered.
There was so much involved in running a kingdom, besides fighting off sellswords and usurpers. She longed for a time when she could truly focus on the details, the ways to improve things.
"First, you must stop chasing your tail," she thought.
Gingerly, the boy rubbed his shoulder as he righted himself.
Your Highness, begging your pardon, but I come with urgent news from Lady Zelda herself. A stream has arrived."
"From where?" "Faria? Night's End?" She would even take one of the Southern Empires at this point.
"Blackstone."
Blackstone? There was nothing left in Blackstone but scoundrels and marauders, the city devastated by its defeat in the Bay of Bounty at the hands of Rhea Loren and her pet sea monster.
"What does it say?"
"Your Highness?"
"The stream. What does it say?"
"Oh, Lady Zelda said not to tell you." Her nerves were pulled as tight as a bowstring, her impatience as thin as spring ice. She grabbed him by the collar and flung him against the wall.
out with it, now. It wasn't complete, he squeaked. Probably just a prank. Some nonsense about madness and cannibals and blood everywhere. The last few words were illegible.
Her entire body froze. She could feel the quiver starting in her toes, but she flexed her muscles and held it off. Placed the messenger back on his feet. He bowed and scampered away. She took a deep breath, let it out, walked on down the corridor calmly, collecting herself with each step.
I am the queen. I must be the calm in the storm.
Her decisions would affect not only herself and her friends and loved ones, but thousands of citizens across the realm. Survivors. People who had been through so much and landed on their feet. The door to the council room stood open. Heated voices echoed from within. Anise entered and said, "Silence!" And they fell away. Eyes met hers, one by one. Taryn, Sejonius, Sir Metz, Private Cheery, Lady Zelda. Fay the blacksmith was there too. These were the people she cared most about. These were the people she was fighting for.
"Anise,"
Lady Zelda said. But Anise stopped her with a raised hand.
"I am no stranger to council," she said, "and I am certain you have much for me. But there isn't time for debate, and I have made my decision."
Upon that last word, it fell so silent, a pin might have been heard as it dropped to the ground. Not just the metallic impact on stone, but the sound of it passing through the air. She turned to Sir Metz.
"I need the army's help. Evacuate every city from Castle Hill to Gearhead to Walburg and all the towns and villages in between. Protect our citizens."
Sir Metz snapped to attention. "It shall be done," he said, saluting. Zelda wore a serious expression.
"Where do you propose we send them? You are talking about tens of thousands of people."
"Anywhere but here. Your lost brother is coming with his horde, and they will spare none. I will send streams to Night's End and Feria, requesting refuge for our people."
Zelda said,
"A bold move, considering we fought both kingdoms in bloody battles in the last few months."
"Night's End answered our call once. They might again," Anise said. "And this is a time to be bold. We can no longer fight amongst ourselves. I don't know about prophecies or magical markings or fate, but I know those who serve themselves will be better off than those who lie in wait for the world to save them."
"What about the rest of the army?"
Taryn asked, though his eyes held that knowing look that told her he already knew her mind as well as she did. He gave her confidence, something she once would have resisted, but now she clung to like a lifeline. It was strange to see him without armor in public, and yet there was something about it she thought she could get used to.
"We prepare for war. Tomorrow could be too late," she thought. "Already armies are amassing, marching to war."
For all she knew, they might already be fighting, killing each other while the true enemy snuck in through the window.
"Immediately."
With that, she turned on her heel and left, heading back to her room to don her armor and prepare the Evenstar for yet another battle. Taryn caught up to her as she was about to enter her quarters. He looked out of breath. She opened her mouth to ask him what was wrong, but he was already grabbing her around the waist, spinning her around, drawing her face to his. Their lips met, and she lost her own breath as they devoured each other for several long moments, breaking the tension in her body. He picked her up, and she wrapped her legs around his hips as he shoved through the door, slamming it loudly behind them.
"I just want to be us again,"
Taryn breathed into her neck, kissing her skin.
"Why won't the world let us?"
Anise sighed, her flesh on fire as his lips painted a trail to the hollow in her throat. She'd wondered the same thing more times than she could count, and she'd finally come up with the answer.
"We are us," she said into his thick, dark hair. "Sometimes I think that's all we are, at our core. That's the one thing the world can't take from us."
His lips grew more desperate, and she lost herself in his eyes. The world could wait a few more minutes. Anise had thought long and hard about who to send the stream to. Her relationship was strong with her cousin, Rhea, as of late, but she was already marching to war. When would she return to Night's End to reply? Would it be soon enough to seek refuge there? Anise didn't think so.
It's a time to be bold, she thought,
plucking the inkpots labelled for the eastern capital of Feria. She penned the message quickly, the words already considered and reconsidered 1,000 times in her head, and signed it with a flourish. She turned to the stream worker and said,
"For the king's eyes only. King Gareth Ironclad."
The stream worker nodded, holding the parchment with 2 hands. Anise watched as she stamped it with the proper level of confidentiality and waded into the icy water. Slowly she submerged the paper until it was fully covered. The words disappeared. Anise let out a breath.
"It is done."
In moments, or perhaps already, the same words would appear in the royal stream in Feria to be captured by one of the king's stream workers on a fresh sheet of parchment. It would be rolled and sealed and presented to the king. His reply could come within minutes, a day or two at the most. Would he scoff at her audacity? It was said that the eldest of the ironclad triplets was different to both his brothers and his father, but the times they lived in changed people, sometimes for the better, but more often for the worse. If the king rejected her plea, or ignored it completely,
"I will be leading my people into a death trap."
Anise fought off the urge to wait around. There was too much to do, to prepare. Thankfully, she had Sir Metz, who was as reliable a knight as she'd ever met. He strode up to her just as she was exiting the stream, his gait just a hair short of a jog.
"I have sent my fastest soldiers to all of the major cities east of Castle Hill. They will organize the evacuations."
Anise nodded, her lips pulled tight. Running felt like such a craven response to a threat, something her father would never have done.
"My father was a tyrant," she reminded herself.
"And this is no ordinary threat. First, secure your people. Then think about military response."
"And the outlying villages?" she asked.
"They are many and scattered," the knight said, "but we are casting as wide a net as possible. Any that we have inkreeds for are being sent streams, which will then be followed up by one of my soldiers."
"Good. I—"
Anise felt a sudden wave of emotion.
"You have done well in my employ, sir. I know I can always count on you."
Metz looked slightly uncomfortable at the compliment.
"Do you require anything additional?"
"Thank you, sir. That will be all for now."
He saluted, turned on his heel and marched away, a half step quicker than he'd arrived. She watched him go, wondering when she'd see him again. She glanced back at the stream one more time before she left, but the waters were calm and flat. The stream worker sat on a bench, awaiting any incoming streams. Anise called out to her.
"Forward any response from King Ironclad to all northern cities save Blackstone."
The woman turned back.
"Yes, Your Highness. And be certain to evacuate with the rest of the city. No more than 2 days hence." "Of course, Your Highness."
Anise offered a final nod, satisfied that her plans were being carried out as she hoped. As she walked through the castle of her childhood, it felt like a hollow place, full of strange shadows and foreign odours. Nothing about it felt like home.
"When I return, I will make it my home."
First, she would redecorate, replacing all her father's darkly violent paintings, and replacing them with something more cheerful. Add some plush rugs, brighter wall sconces, tapestries. Yes, it would do just fine. She laughed at her own foolish thoughts. Who dreamed of decorating a castle when facing a cannibalistic horde of barbarians? She stopped suddenly, her hand moving to her mouth when her laugh morphed into a choking sob. Archer wouldn't get to see the changes. She wouldn't get to argue with him about colour patterns, and he wouldn't have the opportunity to suggest they place swords and javelins on the walls, which he knew she would hate. The thought of entering his room, going through his things. She dashed away the tears making their way down her cheeks. She firmed up her jaw, remembering the monsters that took everything from her.
"I will kill them for Archer. I will kill them all."
She strode from the castle and down the staircase that led to the river. Sojonius met her halfway down the steps.
"You don't have to do this," he said. We can go, rally the troops at Raiders Pass. Stay here for a while. You have time. A few days at the least. I cannot stay here, she said, hoping he would understand the true meaning behind her words. You need time to grieve. That's the last thing I need, she said, refusing the tears that always seemed to be knocking on the back of her eyes. She started to push past him. He caught her with his hand. She hadn't planned it, but she fell into his arms, which circled her the way they used to, when she was a little girl and she couldn't take one more awful insult from the lordlings, and he found her crying in one of her many hidey-holes throughout the castle. She didn't cry now, just soaked up every bit of comfort she could get. It should have been me, Jonias said. Anise froze. Don't say that. One life cannot be exchanged for another. He sighed, his chin pressing against her scalp. You and Archer are the only reasons I'm alive, he said. When Darkspell's potion turned me into that savage bear, I felt strange. I could see all the horrible things I'd done over my lifetime stacked on top of one another. It was like they had created the bear, the monster I'd become. You don't have to tell me this, Anise said. She knew too much of monsters already. I want to. I need to. When I was the bear, I wanted to kill, to spill blood, and hopefully to have my blood spilled. I wanted to die. I was planning to die. He paused, seeming to gather his thoughts as he pulled away so he could look her in the eyes. Then I saw you. I thought you were going to kill me, Anise said. She meant it as a light-hearted jape, but he shook his head seriously. I could never. Archer and you were like the children my wife and I could never have. I loved him like a son, and you like a daughter. Anise reached up and brushed the tear from his face. Well, you still have a daughter, sir, and I still have a loyal protector. Now come, the day grows wings. She linked her arm in his, and started down the steps once more.
Zelda was the only one standing in the boat, taking large bites of a thick slice of buttered sour bread. Terin took up an entire bench on his own, leaning back and letting the air wash over his face. Fay had plopped down at the far end of the vessel, a small box of tools at her feet. She'd come at Anise's request. Terin needed a new set of armor after the last one was abandoned on the shores of Crimea. Sir Jonias sat in the middle, manning the main set of oars for the time being. The other oars were gripped by soldiers, three men and three women, who wore linens, their plate left behind. They could be outfitted when they reached Gearhead. They still carried weapons, long swords and daggers, but no shields. They needed to be light and fast. Anise dangled a finger in the water, which was still icy cold. She remembered Terin's warmth just a few hours earlier, how it had pained her to break off their embrace. Sacrifice. That was what it meant to be a queen. Her life was not her own, but her people's. It was something her father had never understood.
I never understood it either. Not until I lost my mother, Sir Craig, Archer.
How could she be the strong queen the North needed when she felt so broken inside? Terin reached out and gripped her hand, pulling it from the water. She'd forgotten it was still there, growing colder by the second. Another couple minutes and frostbite would have set in.
Welcome to spring in the north, she thought. As cold as winter in most places.
Slowly, he massaged the feeling back into her fingers.
Thank you, she mouthed.
For what?
He mouthed back. She almost laughed, because of the innocence of the question.
Only for everything, she wanted to tell him, but he already knew that,
just as she knew he was grateful for just as much from her. They'd been reunited when they'd been at their most broken. Only together could they be whole again. It was something it had taken them both a long while to truly understand. The harsh northern landscape drifted past, the Snake River narrowing slightly, lending speed to the current. By midday they would reach their destination.
What if we don't stop there?
By nightfall they could be through Raiders Pass, skating across Hyrule Lake, drawing a line between the eastern and western kingdoms. In 3 days they could reach the Burning Sea. From there it was but a short jaunt to the bloody canyons of Fanes. Chopped up like this, their world suddenly seemed a very small place. And about to get smaller, Anise thought, holding Terin's hand tighter. But no, she wouldn't leave the North behind. Not ever again. If she was leaving the borders, she was taking her people with her. All of them. 68. The Western Kingdom, Sarris. Lisbeth Lorne. Lisbeth couldn't even see the blood that had been spilled on her watch, which almost made it worse. Over the last week, the Sleeping Knights had cut straight through the heart of the West. The small traveller's village of Restor had been burned to the ground, the people slaughtered. She'd pushed harder against the Knights than ever before, eventually losing consciousness. She'd awoken with Sir Dietrich sitting beside her. His soul was haggard and faded, and she knew he'd fought against them once more. And again, he'd lost. She felt so alone in that moment. Yet they could have killed him. They could have killed him any time they wanted.
"He is not the enemy," they told her. "Neither are you. We only kill the enemy."
Now they approached Sarris, one of the western cities bordering Fanes. It was surrounded by a large square wall, its sole a pale yellow. A bell was already ringing from within. Orange-souled archers stood at the ready, aiming in their direction. It was Bethany all over again.
"Why am I here?"
Lisbeth wondered, not for the first or last time. Was she just a witness to the violence she'd unleashed, or did she have a greater purpose?
"I must bear this marking for a reason. It is my burden, but it must be more than that."
She had to believe it. "Lisbeth," Sir Dietrich said. Next to her, his soul was a deep blue flame. It had always manifested itself as various shades of blue, but never with the fire-like quality it held now.
I don't think I can do this again," she said.
"You can," he said, his voice so full of certainty that it took her breath away. "But you don't have to. They are not your responsibility." She wanted to believe him. Desperately wanted to believe. But it was a lie.
"I freed them.
To save the North. Not to slaughter the rest of the realms."
"The two things are one and the same."
His soul tossed from side to side, frustrated.
"He hurts for me," she sensed.
And yet still she felt so alone, utterly alone. The Knights were running now, fiery souls filled with a level of rage that could only be achieved over centuries of imprisonment. "Stay," Sir Dietrich said, grabbing her hand.
"I cannot," she said,
and she pulled away, racing after them, already casting her soul out from her forehead. This time, Lisbeth lasted longer in the black pit of the Knight's souls, delved deeper, felt their mania in the core of her own soul. She tried to impose her will upon it, but it only twisted and squirmed from her reach, as slippery as an eel. Her strength flagged. Her blue-flamed soul strode into the mess of souls, most of which were fading, drifting toward the sky. He fought for her. Sir Dietrich spun and whirled and slashed and struck. For a moment the dark souls weakened, and she pushed against them. There was a soft spot, a chink in their collective armor. She formed her own soul into a spear, probing for that weakness. Sir Dietrich screamed, falling back, hit from two sides by powerful blows. His sword flew from his hands, his soul ratcheting back off a hard part of the inner castle. The weak spot was gone, and Lisbeth was crushed by 100 ancient souls pressing in against her.
"Do not become our enemy, enemy, enemy."
Blessed blackness took her. Warmth. It was a strange feeling for her. Lisbeth had always felt warm, even in the frozen North, her soul like a living fire within her. But this wasn't her own inner heat. No, This came from all around her, from a weight pressing into her back, from objects roped around her, holding her close. The blue flames were everywhere. They reached for her, soft against her skin. She felt her own soul respond, yearning for the touch of another soul, one other than the dark pit of the nights. So close now, a finger-width, a hair's breadth. It was as easy as falling, as easy as sinking into a pool of warm water.
No!
She jolted upright just in time, the instant before their souls touched, before she could hurt him, show him his darkest memories, lay his forbidden secrets bare. She scrabbled away on hands and knees, spinning to ensure he hadn't followed her.
I'm sorry, Sir Dietrich said, sitting up too, his hands held up at his sides. I was just doing as you asked.
Oh, heavens, Lisbeth thought. I've offended him.
Which wasn't her intention at all.
No, it didn't bother me. I liked it. You holding me, that is.
You did? His blue soul formed two pink spots.
Then why did you—
I was scared I would hurt you. Like before, in the hinterlands. My soul is a powerful thing. A weapon.
Dietrich eased forward, stopping just short of her.
You don't have to be scared any more.
That's when she noticed the way his soul frayed on the edges, even more than before, wispy tendrils leaking away from the greater mass.
You're hurt,
she said, horrified. Everything came back to her in a rush. The attack on Saris, the knights, Sir Dietrich.
I've been better, he said, coughing out a laugh. But I've also been worse. A few more dents in my armour. A few more scars on my skin. This is life as a sword-marked knight. I'm used to it.
How are we still alive?
She wondered. The sleeping knights had spared them once more.
They are bound by their oath to protect the North. We are not a danger to the North. Not yet. But if we keep trying to stop them, they might change their minds.
I want to touch you, Dietrich said, his voice husky.
His hand was moving toward her slowly, gently.
Sir, please, I'm sorry. I can't. Not right now.
The pink faded from his soul, which darkened to navy.
I understand.
He stood, his soul stiffening.
The knights are preparing to move. They left none but us alive. You slept for a long time.
He turned to go.
Thank you,
she said,
for helping me, for holding me while I slept, for not leaving.
His soul softened slightly. I'm not the leaving type, he said. Not when there's something I believe in. 69. Sir Dietrich. The Western Kingdom, Saris.
I'm a damn fool, Sir Dietrich thought, as he walked away from Lisbeth. She was an enigma, an untouchable flame.
And yet he tried to touch her, believing for some strange reason that she was a part of a destiny that had long eluded him. But watching her lie there in her diaphanous blue dress, her chest rising and falling in slumber, the curve of her hips providing the barest suggestion of what lay beneath, had been enough to slay him.
Hold me,
she'd said before, the words like music to his lips. But then to see that fear in her sightless eyes, because of him. He never wanted to see that again, never wanted to cause that. He knew he would go to the ends of the earth for her, even if just to be in her company. He sensed her rising to her feet behind him, following in his wake, though he couldn't hear her. Lisbeth's grace akin to the flight of a hummingbird, the dance of a kite on the wind. Just ahead, the knights marched south, the shadow of the Southron gates falling across them. Dietrich hated them like he'd never hated anyone before, save perhaps the dread king the moment he'd killed his father. He didn't care that they'd helped save Darin or Castle Hill. These ancient cretins were causing Lisbeth pain, and he simply could not abide such a thing. He jogged forward until he managed to match the stride of one of them, marching at the rear. "Do you have a name?" he asked. The knight didn't look at him.
"My name is unimportant," he said,
using that eerie manner of communication that bypassed Dietrich's ears and echoed directly into his head.
"We are one. Our purpose is one."
"To protect the North?" The knight didn't answer. Dietrich said, "What if the North was under attack right now?" Every knight halted at the question, their heads slowly turning toward him.
"The North will only be safe when its enemies are laid low," they said, as one.
"You didn't answer my question."
"By whom? The stream was clear. The Easterners and Westerners have formed an alliance. They march on Fanes. The Calypsians were defeated at Feria. Our enemies are here."
"You can't know that for certain, can you? What of the Ghazi in the hinterlands? They could be swarming the kingdom at this exact moment, and instead of protecting it, you're massacring innocents." There was a collective growl, and one of the knights stepped forward, grabbing Dietrich by the scruff of his neck, lifting him high in the air. Frozen hell, they are strong. He didn't balk, however, meeting the warrior's ancient eyes.
"You said I am not the enemy," he said.
The knight stared at him for several long moments, and then placed him back on his feet.
"You are not," he said. "You are merely a distraction. Do as you will. Your suggestions change nothing. The North is secure. We march on Fanes. Two kingdoms and an empire will fall with a single thrust. Calip will be next."
With that, the knights marched on, lengthening their strides even more. Lisbeth appeared at his side, a wisp of blue on the edge of his vision.
"I won't fault if you leave, sir."
"David," Sir Dietrich said. "Please, call me David."
"David,"
she said, his name sounding more beautiful on her tongue than anything he'd ever heard.
"And I'm not leaving."
He fell in behind the knights, preparing himself for the fight of his life. 70. The Southern Empire, Calip. Gwendolyn Storm. Gwen wasn't the least bit afraid of heights, and yet she held on to the spike in front of her like it was the only thing preventing her from falling hundreds of feet to her death. Because it was. The ground so distant it might have been a foreign land, the air rushing through her hair. Zoon was a series of toy buildings. She could crush the fighting pits between her fingers if she wanted to. In front of her, Raven patted the dragon's neck with one hand. Her other arm hung limp at her side. She whispered something, and the dragon's wings seemed to beat harder. Magnificent. They were magnificent.
"This creature is magnificent," Gwen thought,
the realization as painful as anything she'd ever felt. Because she'd killed dragons. Yes, they were threatening her people, killing her people, but still, she'd killed them without thought. She felt ashamed. Whisper was on her stomach, slumped over the dragon's leathery back, in between rows of spikes. She looked dead, but Gwen could see the slight rise and fall of her chest. A bulging bruise stood out on her forehead. Raven's head suddenly sagged.
"Raven,"
Gwen said sharply, forgetting her own fear and releasing the spike to get a better look at her riding companion. She sucked in a whistling breath when she saw her face. The swelling had gotten worse, blood continuing to leak from a dozen wounds.
"None of them are mortal," she thought,
which meant Raven had simply passed out from exhaustion or the pain.
"I am riding a dragon, and I'm the only one awake," Gwen thought, allowing herself a nervous laugh. "The world has truly gone mad. Gareth and Rhone won't believe it when I tell them."
She hoped she would get the chance. She remembered the agreement she'd made with Raven. An alliance, a true alliance, with the East, in exchange for her helping Raven take back her empire from her aunt.
"What was I thinking?"
"You were thinking about being different. You were thinking about the future, rather than the past."
The dragon twisted its head to look back, and Gwen's heart skipped a beat. Heated air rippled from its nostrils. Not it.
Her. This dragon is a female, she reminded herself.
What had Raven called her?
Ciri, she said.
The dragon bucked her head upon hearing her name. There was something else there, too, a deep, fathomless look in her eyes. Gwen couldn't read the dragon's expression so much as feel it in the core of her heart. It was gratitude. Her heart was in her throat, the wind whipping past her so hard it was as if it was punching holes through her chest. The ground got closer and closer. Gwen tried to scream, but couldn't find her voice. Her cheeks flapped against her teeth. Her armor seemed to squeeze against her until she couldn't breathe. A side stream of wind hit her, and she began to spin, the ground spiraling like a kaleidoscope. It was so beautiful, all painted colors and breaths of ocean and rolling desert sands. It was going to crush her. Time poured through her fingers. Her 9 decades of life felt but an instant next to the inevitability of this end. 5 seconds to impact. 4, 3, 2. Gwen awoke with a jerk, her body convulsing. She tipped from her precarious perch on the dragon's back, scrabbling at the red scales, missing her attempt to grab one of the spikes, sliding away. A strong hand seized the collar of her armor, pulling her back astride. She panted, so tired she might have run a great distance.
A dream. It had only been a dream. Thank you, she managed.
Ciri would have caught you anyway, Raven said.
Her voice still sounded thick, like she was speaking with food in her mouth.
Maybe.
The final word was a stark reminder that Gwen was well out of her element, the armored trees of Ironwood as distant as the ground below her.
How is Whisper? She asked,
peeking around Raven's back to find the girl still sleeping.
Dead to the world, Raven said.
And you? Raven managed a laugh, though it sounded strange and ended in a hacking cough.
Do you care?
No.
Maybe.
She laughed again.
I feel like I received the beating of my life.
Sorry about that. A pause.
Why did you spare me?
I don't know.
Not exactly. That's not exactly comforting.
Aye, for me either.
That's the best answer I have. Fair enough. But you meant what you said about helping me.
If you meant what you promised.
I did. Then, yes, I will do what I can to restore you to the Dragon Throne. And I will make peace with the East.
It was the weirdest conversation Gwen had ever had, and that was saying something, considering how much time she'd spent with Roan and Gareth.
Your dragon, Ciri, is beautiful, Gwen said,
after a few moments of awkward silence. Something rumbled beneath her, shaking her entire body.
What was that? She's pleased by your words. She's purring.
Who knew that dragons purred? Gwen thought.
Women like to be complimented, Gwen said. Not me. Truly. Truly. Give me a warm bath and a box of sweets any day. My ego doesn't require a boost.
That's because it's so large.
Amusing. I wasn't aware Orion assassins could be so funny. Though the fact that I can't use one of my arms, or one of my eyes, would argue the opposite.
I really am sorry for that.
You're forgiven.
What?
Don't make me say it twice. You spared my sister. You spared me. You gave me something I haven't had in a long time.
What's that?
Hope. Ciri, descend.
The dragon banked sharply, and then began to spiral downward. The dragon was sleeping, stretched out across the desert. Ciri's spiked tail twitched from time to time, and Gwen kept a close eye on it. Whisper was not sleeping, glaring between she and Raven, shaking her head. Gwen wasn't certain who Whisper was angrier with.
You hit me, she said to Raven. And you,
she practically spat the word.
Sister, she saved us, Raven said. Your arm is broken. Don't think I can't tell. And your face. It will heal. It was a good fight.
Gwen snorted. Despite herself, she was beginning to enjoy Raven's understated humour.
Don't you laugh, Whisper growled. You have no right.
It was true. I'm sorry. That's all I can say.
It's not enough.
I'm very sorry. This time it was Raven who snorted, which almost made Gwen double over with laughter. She knew she was acting crazy and not like herself at all, but something about almost dying and flying and sitting in the middle of the Calypsian desert made her feel giddy.
What is wrong with you two?
Raven looked at Gwen, and Gwen looked back. They both started laughing again.
Dragon fire, bodies piling up, smoke and ash and death on all sides.
Gwen stopped laughing, feeling cold in the heat. We need something to eat to keep up our strength, she said. Raven gave her an odd look. Whisper said,
We? Our? You are leaving. We,
she gestured to her sister,
are flying to Calypso.
Raven said,
No, we made a deal.
What? She is the enemy, sister. She came to kill us.
But she didn't, and she's not the enemy, not anymore.
Whisper stood up, shaking her head.
This is madness. The world is changing, sister,
Raven said.
No, no, it will never change. You taught me that. People will keep dying. Wars will keep raging. Families will be torn apart. Nothing changes. This will. You will see. What are you going to do?
We,
Raven gestured to all three of them,
are going back to Calypso. The throne is mine, and we will take it back.
Whisper's eyes closed, opened.
I'll catch a few lizards. I trust you eat meat.
Gwen nodded, glad it was she and not Roan being asked the question.
Roan, where are you?
She blinked the question away. He was doing his part to achieve peace, and she needed to do hers. Raven was staring at her, as was Ciri, one enormous eye trained in her direction.
What?
She asked.
Ciri wants to know why you don't want to kill her,
Raven said. Gwen shook her head. She was still getting used to the fact that dragons could communicate.
She can read my thoughts.
She remembered that deep, wise voice in her head back in Faria, and then again in Zune. Raven shook her head.
Not like you think. Only if you want her to. There are some dragons that will try to force their way into your head, but not Ciri. She's a lady.
Gwen almost laughed, but she was still hung up on the first part of what Raven had said.
What would happen if a dragon forced its way into my head? She asked.
Raven tilted her head to the side as if the answer was obvious.
Why? You'd go mad, of course.
Gwen suddenly wished she was back in Ironwood with the ore creatures she understood. 71. The Southern Empire, Dragon Bay. Goggin. Goggin's thick arms felt like rubber. His skin was burned and blistering after days under the harsh sun. The currents had been fighting him the entire way as he rowed his small boat from the dreadnoughts toward the main Calypsian peninsula. At first he felt like he was making good progress, the Skara Desert to the distant west passing by quickly, but he soon realized that distance was difficult to judge on the open sea. Finally, however, the day had come when he would make landfall. He'd spied the reflection of the sun on the glass-domed archives of Citadel from a long way off, and steered his course further westward. Though landing at the City of Wisdom was tempting, he could borrow a guanic for the remainder of the trip. It was a foolish idea. For all he knew, those who'd usurped the Empire were watching all the ports. Beneath his oars, the water turned dark blue to green to turquoise, and then he was in the shallows. The urge to leap from the boat and plunge into the water was powerful, but he resisted. He could feel the weight of the small pouch tied to his belt, the one that contained the sand from the dreadnoughts.
My army,
he thought, a spark of fear igniting in his chest. There was no going back now. He would make his way to Calypso, determine the situation, and then decide what to do. But he wouldn't hesitate to spill the sand if he needed to. Sometimes monsters were required, where men and women failed. He didn't bother dragging the boat ashore, watching it drift away. He wondered whether it would float all the way back to the dreadnoughts, whether Joaquin would find it. He dashed away the thought, taking a moment to untie his pouch and peek in at the sand. The grains shifted slightly under his gaze.
"Such a small thing," he thought.
He'd always believed that size and strength were power. And then he'd met Raven. She was such a slight woman, less than half his size, less than half his strength. But that didn't mean she wasn't powerful. He prayed to all the gods he'd ignored most of his life that she was still alive. He closed the pouch and tied it off, testing the knots thrice before allowing it to dangle from his waist once more. He eyed the position of the sun, using it to determine the correct direction. And then he started walking. His back was bent, his legs as limp as the body of a dead snake. Goggin's water had run out a day earlier. He'd found a few plants known to contain moisture, but when he cracked them open, they were dried-out husks. Like him, it was a wonder they were still standing at all. His stomach no longer growled nor ached, too shrunken even for that. He knew he had to be close, or at least that was what he told himself. In truth, if he'd missed his aim, he could be wandering a barren desert hundreds of miles wide in each direction. He staggered on, each step harder than the last. After a time, his legs faltered and then gave out completely. From there he crawled, first like a child, then like a snake, dragging himself across the rough terrain. Eventually he stopped. The relentless sun did not, baking him alive as he slept. For the second time in as many months, Goggin awoke, staring at a stranger. He was dark-skinned, with dark eyes, clearly Calypsian, a thatched roof hovering over his head like a fancy hat. "You should be dead," he said. Goggin said, "Ugh," by which he meant, "I'm not." "You have no possessions but a bag of sand." Goggin reached for the pouch tied to his waist, but found nothing. He tried to sit up, but couldn't even lift his head.
"Wah,"
he said. It was slightly more coherent than his last attempt at speech, and the man offered a ladle of water, which he lapped at like a cat. "Slowly," the man said, "or you'll be ill." The water cooled his parched throat, and he closed his eyes.
"Where am I?"
There were small villages scattered throughout the desert, but most of them were located close enough to the cities that they could travel there to sell their wares and resupply. He was well away from Citadel, and nowhere near Zune, which meant he must be near Calypso.
"How far to Calypso?"
he rasped. "For you? A 12-day crawl?" The man chuckled slightly at his own joke. He ran a hand over his bald scalp. "For a normal man, half a day. We go there often." He tried to sit up again, but found his own weight as heavy as a mountain.
"I must go. Immediately."
"You are dehydrated and malnourished and suffering from overexposure to the sun. You must rest and recover. A week at the least."
"A day at the most," Goggin said.
"I cannot stop you."
"No,"
Goggin agreed.
"You cannot."
Later, when Goggin managed to sit up and the man brought cold, fruity soup and a small spoon, Goggin said,
"Thank you."
"My wife made the soup."
"I meant for saving my life."
"You don't like the soup?" He chuckled again. "Sorry, I like to laugh. At myself, most often." Goggin managed to smile, though it felt as weak as his body.
"The soup is good. Give your wife my thanks for that, too. My first wife made soup like this."
"She died?" Goggin snorted out a laugh.
"That demon can't be killed."
He spooned more soup while the man watched him curiously. "Why are you so anxious to get to Calypso? The city is in chaos." Goggin froze.
"What kind of chaos?"
"How long have you been wandering the desert?" the man asked. narrowing his eyes.
"Felt like forever."
"That's a long time."
"Calypso,"
Goggin said, trying to get the conversation back on track. His heart was pounding too fast, too hard. "After the defeat in Feria..."
"What defeat?"
The man's eyes widened. "It's all anyone has been talking about."
"Enlighten me."
"The dragons were killed. The defeat was absolute."
"Oh, gods. I pushed Raven into the attack. She tried to stop it, but Shanalyn... Oh, Raven, I'm sorry. So sorry." "What else?"
Goggin growled. "There is a new empress, but that's only the start of it."
"Holy gods, so it's true. The coup in the east was only the beginning." "What empress?"
"Viper Sands."
"The snake."
Goggin wondered if she was behind the dragon attack, or if the two events were unrelated.
"What of her niece, Whisper?"
He kept his voice even, steady. "Zoon," he said.
"What?"
"The fighting pits. Raven and Whisper are both there. Word is that they've been fighting together every night. Beasts, other criminals. They haven't been killed yet, or so I've been told. But they will. None survive the pit." Though the news was a shock, Goggin focused on only one part of it.
"They're alive. She's alive."
It didn't matter that it made no sense, only that it was true. It was all the motivation he needed. But he was only one man, his guanero murdered in the ocean, drowned with their steeds.
"Yes, one man. A man with an army of monsters." "Where is my sand?"
he asked. "Just here," the man said, gesturing to a bench with a pouch on it. Goggin smiled. 72. Tarragon. Rhône Lorraine. Tarragon was a strange place, thick with lush, tangled jungles and dry flatlands devoid of life. Windy navigated using a detailed map from one of the books he'd brought, saying little, muttering often. Yila, accustomed to such behavior, barely seemed to notice her eccentricities. Rhône, on the other hand, couldn't hold his tongue. "What was that?" he asked, after she'd been muttering non-stop for several minutes. Windy's head jerked up from the map, looking at him as if his appearance was as unexpected as a spring beetle in a snowstorm.
"You want tea?" she asked. "Yes. We should stop for tea."
Rhône groaned, though he'd brought it on himself.
"Why can't I keep my mouth shut?"
They stopped, and Yila built a small fire, coaxing it with dry palm fronds. Windy boiled tea. Rhône gestured to a soft spot of ground, the mud oozing from a recent rain.
"We could just drink that and save you the trouble."
"Your humor devolves with each passing day,"
Windy said, pouring a cup of boiling sludge.
"Have you been ill?"
The change of pace surprised him. "No."
"The tea,"
Windy said with a wink, passing him a cup. Rhône wrinkled his nose at the smell, held his breath and sculled it, trying not to spew it back up. He thought, perhaps, the mud would taste better.
"Satisfied?" he said. "Not until we find Black Boots,"
Windy said, hurriedly packing up their things.
"I guess morning tea is over already,"
Rhône thought wryly. He stood and turned to head back down the path, nearly screaming when he came face to face with several bodies nestled before him, blocking the way forward. Their skin was a deep, rich crimson, their hair coppery. The men wore their hair long, almost to their waists, while the women kept it hacked short. They were lean and tall, holding crude weapons, naught but sticks sharpened to points. Behind him, Windy said,
"We are travelling to Shai. Are we going in the right direction?"
Rhône was stunned by her audacity. They knew nothing about these people, and she was asking for directions. "Yes," one of them said, a woman with sparkling blue eyes. "But there is nothing there. The slavers return from time to time, so no one lives in the village any more." Roan eyed the weapons, and the woman noticed. For hunting. Wild pigs. They are strong, even when caught in our traps. Roan released a sigh of relief, glad that the books were right. Even after